Hello, welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Matt Truman. Company 3 has grown into one of the leading new theatres in the country. Indeed, it has pioneered a new approach to youth theatre. Not as an after-school club for kids to try their hand at acting, but as a space for teenage self-expression. Its 75 members, all individually nominated to join by local community leaders, work with professional artists to devise new work about their own experiences as young people in Britain today. In 2014, one of their shows, an examination of teenage neurology called Brainstorm, transferred all the way to the National Theatre. If that particular transfer was a one-off, though, it wasn't down to a lack of quality. Rather, to a rigorous reflexive practice that asks where and how the company can be most useful, be that talking directly to parents, carers and teachers, or opening a space for members to use as they see fit. That pragmatic, outward-facing approach is what sets Company 3 apart for me, and there are fewer better advocates for socially engaged practice as its artistic director, Ned Glazier. I went along to the Company 3 den upstairs at Islington Community Library to meet him.
We speak about the reason that the company exists as being to give teenagers a space to tell their own stories and to make their own change. And we do that, I think, in pursuit of a world which better understands and listens to and understands teenagers. And to do that, we do three things. And those three things sound really simple, but I think, like all the really simple things, they contain all the really complex things too. And so the three things we say we do are, one, we make space in which young people can feel genuinely safe to express themselves and to be themselves. And that's part of that is the long-term relationship that we build with young people. But there's lots of other things we do as well, and we can talk about those, I guess. The second is that we make plays that speak really deeply of the changes that the young people want to see in the world and who they are. And we do that for an audience which we deliberately aim that at an audience of the people who are most likely to have the most impact on the young people's lives. So when I started the company, everyone told me, and I think I believed it, that you should have more than a friends and family audience. But then I learnt... I suddenly realised that the audience that we have was the audience that everyone else in theatre wants. The audience that we have a very diverse, mixed audience in terms of race and class. They enter the theatres that we work in really assured of their space and their right to be there. They come in wanting the show to be good, which I think you can't say for many other audiences. And they stay and they chat afterwards. And then they make, I hope, they take some of the things they've learnt in that show or taken from that show and they use it to change the way they treat teenagers. So there's the space that we make where teenagers feel really safe, hopefully. There's, out of that space, all the things that emerge and the conversations that happen in that space then drive the work that we produce. And we produce that work and create that work in a way that... as much as possible democratises the way that the young people can author and affect and generate that work so that it really speaks of them. But there's always a collaboration with an adult artist. And then what we realised, so we did that for quite a long time and we had those two elements of our work, but this kind of quite big mission to change the way the world sees teenagers. And what we realised was that what we thought about was how do we then achieve scale? How do we, if we have this quite campaigning aim for the company, how do we then change, how do we change the world a bit more? And I don't think we can tour our work very successfully. It's really expensive. Young people are in schools. Parents aren't really up for taking them on tour. And when you go on tour, you spend a lot of money reaching the people who are probably already converted and who don't feel the same connection to the young people who are in on the stage that they're looking at. And so what we did was we decided as a company to kind of an adopt a really open principle of sharing everything that we do. And so we will openly share our process and our practice and our plays with anyone in the world who might find them useful to adapt for their own specific context and the young people that they work with, or for young people to take themselves and use as well. And that means that there are 60 companies of young people who in the last 2 years have made a play about teenage brain development for their parents and their friends and their teachers and, you know, the people in their communities. We're really lucky. Like, I think you have to fight for the first thing in order to get the last thing. That's what I think. I think that if in order to achieve that amplification, the work has to be... You have to work really hard in the middle. So we often draw those three parts of our thing as like concentric circles. And we start with the kind of hot middle of making this a safe space for teenagers to really speak about what they think about the world and what they think about themselves. And so yesterday, just there on a sofa, just near where we're sitting right now, I was working with a group of five teenagers and we played they kind of invented an exercise where one of them said a very small worry that they have and the next one had to say a slightly bigger worry, and very quickly we were talking about their bodies and we were talking about their fear of getting dementia one day and their fear of their grandparents dying and of climate emergency, and you know, and so very quickly all those things are in the room. But unless you safeguard that space, unless you really actively fight for that space, and you don't assume it. I think something that often is quite problematic in the arts is that we assume a safe space. Like, because it's got the word rehearsal room on the door, someone's decided that's a safe space. And I think that's actually potentially really dangerous, because that someone has assumed it on their own basis. Has assumed it. So we fight really hard for the safety of the space first and foremost. And from that you get the stories and the ideas and the needs of the young people. And from there you make the work. And so there's two things working in parallel. One is the creation of the plays, and then producing those plays for the audience means that we're testing, and we make our plays in stages. So lots of youth theatres make their plays once and it's good. And then they make another play. But what we've learned is that if we're going to make, or try at least to make really exceptional work, that we can't just make it once. We have to make it once and then make it again and then make it again. And so our best work has had at least three sets of productions.
Let's go back to the very beginning then. Starting this company as a kind of space for young people.
Yeah.
Tell me about how it came about.
It came about because I took a job as a director with a youth theatre for a single show in 2008. And the show was Sweeney Todd. It was not the Sondheim Sweeney Todd. It was a weird school's musical Sweeney Todd. It was quite bad. It wasn't my choice. I mean, it's terrible that I've told you this now, because basically it's like the hidden terrible secret of Company 3 is that that's where we started. And I've been working locally. I worked for the Almeida Theatre and I knew the local area and I lived locally. And there was this group of teenagers in this after-school club youth theatre who were kind of very self-selecting in that group were, you know, like it was a nice social club, I think, at the time. They used to come in, the call was 5 o'clock and they used to turn up at 5:15 and we'd work for 45 minutes and then have a 10 minute break, which turned into a 45 minute break, and then do 50 minutes more work and go home. And I made that show and it went down quite well, and I think they had a good time, and we realised there was loads more potential in this company than was there, and there wasn't a structure around it, and you know, and so I suggested to the people who were running it, who were based in the local council, that we set up a charity, and that became the company. And that was also the stage where I started, you know, with the next year's production, I started diving into schools more to get nominations for people to come and be part of the company, rather than just for anyone to turn up. Because just inviting anyone to turn up is a form of selection, I think. Everything is a form of selection. There's no way around selection. Some people say you could just be open door, but open door only works for a certain group of young people.
If you know where the door is.
If you know where the door is and you're confident enough to get through it and you feel like you belong in it. And so belonging is a really important thing, and we fight really hard. We've learnt a lot recently about... So we have a research partnership with the University of Sussex, and we've learnt a lot with the School of Psychology there, and we've learnt a lot about something called self-determination theory. And the three conditions for self-determination theory are competence, autonomy, and relatedness. And so sometimes you can create that relatedness, I think, by empowering people, by delivering them a letter saying your school's nominated you to be part of a company. And they're like, they're the quiet ones, and they sit at the back of the room and they don't say much, and suddenly they're like, oh my God, I've been spotted. And then their ownership of their place is greater, and their buy-in to the company is greater as well. And also then you're harnessing this kind of massive range of knowledge of adults in the local area who understand our work and understand the kids they're working with. And so at 11 they can then do that. So we started doing that very early on in our time, and I think that really changed the makeup of the company and the feeling in the company and the mix of the company as well. So suddenly we were representing many more schools, and we had a bigger balance of boys and girls and, you know, things like that.
I'm interested in your journey with this as well. The company has obviously evolved very organically and found its kind of principles out of practice.
Mm.
But when you turned up to direct Pat Sweeney Todd, you said you were a director working with and at the Almela.
Yeah.
Did you classify yourself in a specific way? Were you making this sort of work from the start? What drew you into this form of work?
I mean, the really deep answer to that question is that I had a big shift in my life at 13, and I think about this quite a lot, and it's taken me till my late 30s to work this out. But I had a big shift, and I lived in Hong Kong as a kid, and I moved back from Hong Kong at 13 to London to a really normal school in South London, and it was really hard. It was in year 10, and my parents had divorced, and I learnt a lot in that time. But I suddenly realised a couple of years ago, I was like, oh my gosh, I make a safe space for kids to exist in. And at some point on that journey, theatre become important to me. And so in some ways, I think it's just about putting those things together. I'm really loving theatre and always loving making theatre, not feeling particularly comfortable in the industry, not wanting to maybe buy into some of the things that I felt rightly and wrongly you needed to do in order to be successful in the industry. Even as a middle class man, not feeling particularly comfortable around a lot of practice, I think. And then just really enjoying working with teenagers. Like when I was at the Almeda, I was with the projects, then called the projects department, which was, you know, the outreach and the participation, and I was producing and coordinating and doing a bit of stuff. It took me till I was 28 to name myself as a director, even though that's what I really wanted to be, because I'm not sure I felt like I deserved it. And I think I always wanted to run a youth theatre. Like when I came back to London, my youth theatre was the thing that where I found my friends for the first time, and I think that's really stuck with me. And I think that's what drove it at the time.
What is it about theatre that enables that safe space for young people specifically, do you think?
Well, like part of me kind of wants to say I don't think it matters very much that it's theatre. Like, I do theatre because it's the thing I've done. But I think what that safe space is offered by so many other things as well. I guess where theatre is different is that it forces us to look at each other, doesn't it? Or it invites us to look at each other. It invites us to be together. Like, you can go to football, or you can go to archery, or you can go to boxing, or even dance. I think sometimes like kind of taught dance classes, and maybe you don't interact in quite the same way. But theatre maybe offers the opportunity to to speak, and definitely the way we work, I think it offers the opportunity to get some stuff out and to interact and to think about yourself and the world.
It's quite interesting when you talk of either sport or dance, like there's a sense of disciplines within that, whereas theatre, and specifically the way you work, feels
undisciplined.
Yeah,
I hope so. Like, we have a rule, a mini rule in the... We have three rules in the company. There are no more rules, because some of the schools that our young people go to have, like, a rule book that has 60 rules in it. And how can you possibly remember all of those? And they're all negative. They don't where you don't. And, like, so we have three, and they'd be kind, be brave, and be yourself. And I've never had recourse to any of... And, you know, I've never not been able to cite something back to those rules or solve something using those rules in the 11 years I've been here. And I have a personal rule, which is I'll always try and say yes. So as soon as a young person comes to me and says, Ned, can we, can I, I'll always say yes in my head before they've said the thing. And they know that as well. So they, I mean, there's definitely a power relationship. Do you know what I mean? Like, sometimes they test it in a, you know, fun way. But, like... But I think they find that really unusual.
I mean, I noticed you've got the three rules on the wall in the poster that has three very, very bright colours on it, a kind of pastel green, a bright red and a bright yellow. And in most spaces, that would ping out as the only thing of colour. And yet, in the den, we're surrounded by notice boards covered with pictures in a very kind of tumbling way. There's a drawer full of boxing gloves, there are coloured chairs all over the place, there's a corner of props and costumes, sofas, beanbags, a table with more biscuits than I've ever seen in my life, and fruit for the healthy option. tell me about this space, because it is kind of extraordinary.
So the den is a space at the top of a library in Islington. It's right next to our little office, and we've had it for a year and a bit, and it's become fundamental to our work. It's a space, so the idea of the space is it's a space where any of our young people can come at any point, where they are in control of the space and where the space shifts with the agency of the young people who use it. They can come here to do their homework, they can come here to have a chat, they can come here to make their own work, they can come here to kick balls at each other's heads, that's often what happens. Sometimes Nasima comes here after school and there's a microphone and a sound desk and she just sings into it really loudly for an hour. It's something that's really important in our work that I've learned over the last few years, and I've learned it from biology and permaculture and stuff like this, is this idea of edgelands. And edgelands are the spaces between biospheres, like, so between a field of corn and a field of wheat. The bit in between is the most... biodiverse, is the most fertile. And when I was making Brainstorm with Emily Lim, who is now the director of public acts at the National, is still an associate of the company and we still make work together, she and I noticed a lot of the time that we were rehearsing and it was quite difficult, and we were trying to make this space where everyone felt very free, but it wasn't quite happening because it felt quite forced. And then we'd leave the room for 15 minutes for a break, and, you know, that's when the work got made, because everyone went a bit wild and someone was doing handstands over in the corner and someone else was rapping into a microphone and someone else was, you know, having a massive argument in the corner or dancing or whatever else. And so since then, we've been trying to kind of create more edges in our work, because I think the biggest thing I do as an artist is listen. And if I can listen really well and in as many complex ways as possible, then I can start to help shape the things that the young people are thinking and want to say, and challenge them and provide space for them. And so I guess in some ways that the den operates as a living embodiment of that, of edge, and of the edge lands. And it's a bit inspired by adventure play. And in adventure play, the agency of the child is always prime. And the job of the adult is to observe and to place things in their path that they might be interested in but not mind when they're not taken, or to facilitate. And I think that a lot of my or to create structures within which they can play. And I think that a lot of the time I see that as my job as an artist working with young people. In a vast majority of the spaces and the context in which artists or children and teenagers make art, it is seen as a way to develop them into adults. So that's, you know, that's kind of, I think that's held in the way that a lot of big theatres or theatre companies deal with education work. It's like, we're going to educate. We're going to help you understand what professional theatre is. You're going to engage with this big idea made by adults. It's in a lot of... like, I ran a workshop at the National Theatre a few years back, and it was all youth theatre participants and their leaders and the directors. And I said, why do you do this? And everyone said... The answers were really brilliant and really inspiring, and but they were all about the transition of these people into adults rather than the capturing of who they were in that moment. And I don't believe that if you ever got a group of professional, kind of inverting commas with my fingers, like professional directors and actors and writers in a room and said, why do you do this? They'd talk about their confidence or their self-development or what they're going to be like when they're 40. What they'd talk about is the way they want to change the world or open up space for conversation or, you know, shining a light in the spaces we don't see so often. And at the very heart of our work here is the idea that that's why theatre should exist with teenagers as well. And so in order to do that, and that takes me back to where I was, I think, that in order to do that well, you need an adult artist who can help create that space in the way that I spoke about, and you need to listen. And you need to listen over years, not for 12 weeks. You need to listen in a way that is about genuinely getting to know people. And so the Den is a space where sometimes I can just, and they know I'm not doing this sneakily, but I can just eavesdrop on conversations. Or I can just see how people react to different things, or I can learn stuff. And that feels like absolutely fundamental to that kind of depth of engagement that then leads to hopefully the honesty and the quality of the work, and then leads, both in process and in plays, to the clarity and the usefulness of the dissemination that comes after.
Let's talk about process then. How does your process as Company 3, and I mean that very much as the collective rather than you as the director, how does that function, and what might surprise an artist who is working in professional kind of spaces and structures about the way you work?
I hope not very much. I hope, I think that maybe the surprise or the thing that we've really worked very hard to do is to try and name process. So a few years ago I had a crisis and I thought I was a really bad artist and I wasn't making the work that I wanted to make and I felt a bit rubbish, and through a series of nice, I don't know if they're coincidences, but like things that came together at the right time, I ended up doing a fellowship at the Barbican that was supported by the Paul Hamlin Foundation, and called and the Artworks Alliance, which is kind of a big program of the development of kind of participatory artists. And I went in with the principal question, how do you make a play? Because I didn't know. And I worked with loads of different artists, and I worked with young people and artists that worked with us, and then some other more experienced artists who came in to kind of provoke. And we ended up trying to name each stage of making a play. And now we use 8 words that represent the journey between source, the starting point, the thing that we're really interested in that we want to talk about, and the final performance. And what that does is that at the very least within the work enables me and the young people to be in the same space. And I think what it starts to do is demystify the idea of making a play. It moves it from being something that might live in my gut. Because as soon as I say, I've just got a feeling, that's how can anyone argue with that in the room? How can anyone say, no, that's not what I was saying, Ned? That doesn't represent me. So if we know at least what stage we're in, then I think that's really helpful. And you know, all of that is kind of in pursuit of the young people having as much authorship as they possibly can of the work, whilst also really understanding the importance of an outside eye and an experienced artist to help shape those spaces in which they might thrive within a piece of work, to help, and sometimes to challenge and to to go, I think what you're saying is this, and for them to go, oh no, that's not what I'm saying, and then, okay, is it this? And they're like, oh yeah, that's really it, or to link them to other work that might help them understand the very difficult conversations we sometimes have. So that's kind of the principle, is that if you name a process, then you can all participate in it better. And then maybe the other thing that might be surprising is that we often start with nothing. So every year we have something called Summer Project. Guess what that is? Which is a week where anyone in the company can come, and we start, and there's some artists in the room and some visiting artists who come in now and again, and we invite them, and we start with nothing, and we start with a conversation. So everyone goes into pairs and they have a conversation about how they are and what's going on and what they're thinking about a lot. What they're thinking about a lot is a really good question, because they like, it's a bit about like, because that can be like your favorite TV show rather than like, something's really making me sad. And then based on the things that come out of those quite big conversations, we respond and we spend the week making. So a year ago, we did Summer Project, and Bailey said, I have been thinking a lot about hypnotism. And Alana said, I've been working out how to biohack myself. And the next day, through the actions of a very talented producer, we had a professor of gene therapy and a professional hypnotist in the room talking about their practice. And so we learn more about that stuff and we research it, and then we were making work based on it. And all of that, from that kind of primordial soup of stuff that comes up, those are the things, and as well as all the conversations we're having in the den or on the residential or, you know, in passing or just after the rehearsal when someone's like, you know, a massive lump of gold falls out of someone's mouth and you're like, what's that? Then that's the stuff that we make work out of.
But the way you describe that, you make it sound somehow magical up here in the den. Like, you know, someone can invoke hypnotism and the next day a hypnotist will appear as if by magic.
It's part of saying yes, though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, we were really lucky that those people were available. And like, I think a lot of the time that what we need to show to young people is possibility, and saying yes does that. And as soon as you do that, then they are able to step into the space that you have offered and express themselves.
But I think that's what I have gotten the sense of by stepping into the den up at the top of the library. It feels a little bit like a magic faraway tree sort of space.
I mean, great. That's exactly what it should be.
Just like the top of the skull has been opened, and here is an noise and colour and, you know, just fizz, really, at some level, even empty with just the two of us in here. I want to ask about the relationship that Company 3 has with the industry, with professional artists and institutions.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that, to invoke the idea of the Edgeland again, you might be a space in between.
I think about this all the time, and I think, when we made Brainstorm, the thing that made Brainstorm was not the promise of a space on a National Theatre stage. It was the investment that the National Theatre made in the work. They gave us space in the studio. I think we used more technical equipment in the studio than anyone's ever used. I think we really took the piss. And Lindsay Turner and Ben Power giving us dramaturgical support and a production manager. And, you know, and it wasn't about... And I think sometimes we make a mistake in, as artists working on those fringes or with young people, or, you know, in what are often called participatory ways or whatever, of kind of demanding space on stage. I think the thing we should be doing is demanding a share of development, and then making our work really excellent, so it can't be... So of course it deserves the space on stage. As soon as we're begging for that space, then we get it like charity, and then it demeans the work because it's not good enough. And like... So I think the thing we need to do is make excellent work. If you then get a share of the things that are often offered to, inverted commas, professional artists and professional processes, then so that's better. But the thing I think that professional spaces offer us, one is like a drive to be really excellent and to learn from the people who are brilliant at doing those things. But it's also like a trampoline that then helps that piece of work reach a really wide audience through its dissemination. So the reason people do Brainstorm, I think, reason people make their own versions of Brainstorm, is because the National helped it be excellent, and because it was on at the National. And so I really like, and so the opportunity to do that sometimes is really exciting, but it's not something we should beg for, because we're making the change. Mm. We're making the change here.
What do you look for in the artists you work with? Is there anything that they've got to have? Could you work with any artist, or is there something that makes it like, yes, this is a Company 3 collaborator?
Well, I mean, the first and really obvious and most important thing is that I don't look like a lot of the young people I work with. I've lived locally for 15 years and I know this area, but I didn't grow up here. And a lot of our young people are black or mixed race, and it feels massively important, and we live this very clearly, that our artists are able to listen in a way that I'm not able to listen to, or that I'm not, by virtue of my experience, able to listen to quite so acutely. And so diversity, and specifically like artists who look like, feel like, share identities with the young people, visible and invisible, perspectives, feels really important, that are different to mine. And then beyond that, the most important, and within that, the very best artists sometimes are the people who've been in the company and gone on to work professionally, because they bring both an understanding of what it's like to be in that room, and some stretch, and some different practice, and some, you know. So at the moment, Kwame Odum, who's an actor and a movement director and a director and a brilliant human, was in the room when I first walked in 2008. He was 14 years old. And now he's leading a whole load of training for us with our young people, and that feels really important.
What's changed over, 11 years then, since 2008, both in terms of the artistic context and the political context?
I think Sarah Jane Blakemore's work, so Sarah Jane is the professor of neuroscience who impacted Brainstorm, like who was a consultant neuroscientist along with Kate Mills on Brainstorm, and she's just published this big book, and I know it's not everything, but I wonder whether, like, I mean, there's so much that's changed, I think. The young people, I think there is there's starting to be the cracks in a society that starts to understand that teenagers are different to children and adults, and that the teenage years aren't a period of time in which you kind of have to force yourself through it, and that you have to transition so that you can, you know, this dark time where you have to suddenly move through and then become an adult. That actually it's a really special time. And you see that in the climate strikes, and you see it in the way that we have started to see that change might exist most in teenagers more than anyone else. And it's no coincidence that teenagers are leading that, and pushing themselves out of what in the last 10 years has become an increasingly restrictive education system, in which voices aren't valued, in which there are lots of great teachers, but also lots of teachers who will silence voices rather than encourage them. And the education system does nothing to help that. And then there's the other thing, which is that 11 or 12 years ago, I was regularly, as an example, I was regularly having to call young people up on using homophobic language, for example, or speaking in ways which today would feel much more unusual. And you know, a little while back, there was a 12-year-old girl in one of our rooms kind of explaining to another group of young people the difference between bisexuality and pansexuality, speaking as an out pansexual young woman, age 12. And I do think, like, the way that teenagers of today speak about identity and who they are, and that their comfort with that, trans rights or race, gender identity, like lots of things, has seen such a massive shift in the last 12 years. And I think we have so much to learn from their ease in that language, in that world, and that, you know, and with each other. There's that thing that links to climate change, I think, which is that one of the reasons that we struggle with it is because we are born into the world and we see the world like it was, like we assume that that's how the world has always been. So when we come into a world and like we see one butterfly a year, we assume that's how it always was. But 30 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, there were loads more butterflies. There is no sense of them having to shift into this present. They are of it, and they are expressing it in a way that's totally unencumbered by anything that's come before. And that's and that makes hopefully our work the most urgent and important that it should be. And and why it's so obvious to me that we shouldn't, you know, I think that, like, I really like, the reason I'm here is not because I care about theatre. The reason I'm here is because I care about teenagers, and I think theatre is quite useful in helping us do that. Because actually, in youth theatre terms, in young people's terms, it's it is genuinely the democratic space that professional theatre sometimes seeks to be and fails to be. Like, it's genuine, the space in the village hall with the families and the friends of the teenagers there. And I really believe in the right of teenagers to speak up, because they're different to adults and they're different to children. If we don't listen to them at the very least, how can we possibly build the structures that will best enable them? Also, they've got some really good ideas and we should listen to them too. But then sometimes I'm like, well, what if in every single city and town and borough and village there was a group of young people who were in some ways enabled to think about themselves and to speak out to their local community? Like, wouldn't that be a brilliant thing? And then I'm like, shit, there is. There's a youth theatre in every single... Like, we have that. The network exists. But they're making Grease. Or they're making an old Oscar Wilde play, or they're making DNA, and all of those things are valid if we're training them to be adults, but they don't help that expression of the present. And so that's part of the reason why I really care about the bigger ripples of this little stone that we're throwing into a pond here, which is that if by openly sharing our practice and our process, and through our training courses or through books or through blueprints or whatever, we can enable other people to adapt and take from those things and make their own version of a space which young people can speak to adults and themselves, then we genuinely can understand that present better and genuinely change the world a bit more, I think.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, for hundreds of interviews with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was presented by me, Matt Truman, and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.